since 1775, generations of Americans have fought for our ideals and our principles. American warriors secured the freedoms to create the United States of America.
They fought to end slavery.
They joined with allies to win two world wars.
They have responded with valor and honor whenever called.
And they have liberated more people around the globe than any military in the history of the world. Our all-volunteer forces of guardsmen, soldiers, sailors, marines, airmen, and reservists continue the mission begun at Lexington and Concord.
Less than 1% of Americans serve in our armed forces.
The least the rest of us can do is to pay attention and get engaged. This program is produced and broadcast for that purpose. It is presented live and worldwide
at 1041kqth.com.
To engage, call 520-751-1041. The American Warrior is on the air.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, your host. Welcome to American Warrior Radio. From April to November of 2006, forces including the United States Army, United States Marines, and Iraqi security forces fought for control of the Al-Anbar government. This included capturing and controlling key locations in Ramadi. The Navy SEALs were there, too. SEAL Michael Mansour was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor during these battles when he threw himself upon a grenade, saving the lives of other members of his team. The Battle of Ramadi was also given a prominent role in the Clint Eastwood film American Sniper. Our guest today was there as well, as a member of SEAL Team 3, also known as the Punishers. He's written a book about his experiences. It's called The Last Punisher, a SEAL Team 3 Sniper's True Account of the Battle of Ramadi. Joining us by phone from probably a secure location somewhere in Florida, welcome to American Warrior, Kevin Lace.
Ben, thanks for having me on. It is quite cold in Florida as of right now.
Oh, wah. Really?
Yeah, actually, it's been chill quite across the country, so we're hanging in there. Should warm up pretty soon.
I don't know. It's going to be about 70 degrees here today, Kevin.
I'm jealous, but
I'm just saying. So, listen, American Warrior is going into, I think it's 14th year, telling the stories of our men and women in the military. So when your publicist contacted me and said, hey, Kevin, Navy SEAL, Ramadi, American Sniper, best-selling book, I thought, yeah, okay, sounds good. Let's put them on. But, Kevin, I started reading your book, and, listen, we've had Navy SEALs on before. We've had the commander of Gemini 4 who almost couldn't close the hatch. We even had a Navy SEAL that carried Jessica Lynch down the stairs in Baghdad. We even had a sailor who achieved 20 years in the Navy despite fighting cerebral palsy. And, Kevin, I got to say, starting off your book, I started to have doubts. I can't remember when we've had a warrior on the show who was such a big quitter. You quit Little League. They almost won the title. You quit. You quit Boy Scouts before earning an Eagle Scout. You quit the high school golf team. What's the story there?
Yeah, I mean, I actually quit college as well, you know, to add insult to injury. But, you know, I guess those were merely setups for what I truly wanted to do. I mean, you know, I had a pretty diverse background growing up. I did a lot of things, and I feel like that weighed heavily in my ability to, you know, do well and flourish in the SEAL teams. You know, like I said, I played a multitude of sports, did Cub Scouts and Boy Scouts, you know, went to college. I did great in high school, but when I finally figured out what I wanted to do when I grew up, which was to be a SEAL after the events of 9/11, I was able to invest all my interest and motivation towards that, and that helped me succeed.
Well, and just to clarify for the, you know, the regular listeners know that I make a habit of out of insulting the men and women who could find me and kill me with a plastic spoon, but the whole point there was, you in your book, you start off by showing the example of, I don't know if you call it a blessing or a curse, but you're a very, very talented athlete, a very talented individual, very skilled in school when you applied yourself. But it wasn't until 9/11 and you went down and saw the Navy recruiter that you found what you thought was probably your best calling at that point in your life.
Right. And you know, in telling this story, my story growing up, you know, I kind of wanted to, you know, add a realistic component to it. I mean, I've read a lot of SEAL books out there, and, you know, it kind of seems like every SEAL has succeeded at everything in life. But that's not always the case. You know, I definitely did well growing up. But it wasn't until I found that trigger, which was 9/11, that kickstarted that focus, that hypervigilant focus. And I put it towards being a SEAL. But, you know, we are human. And I think with The Last Punisher, we wanted to capture that, because a lot of that's missed when people read SEAL books. They kind of see these mythical creatures. It's true, we do some extraordinary stuff, but at the same time, we are human. We do make mistakes, but we do learn from our mistakes. And I think that kind of is what the reader can pull out from that, those stories in the beginning of the book.
Well, Kevin, in all seriousness, I truly enjoyed the book. I'm glad I had the chance to read it. I'm glad you wrote it. And one of the things I found special about the book is just what you touched on is you're not trying to convince somebody that you're some kind of superhuman killing machine. You know, you bring us your touches of your life. Every chapter seems to have sort of a callback to a previous point in life before you get back to Ramadi or whatever you're doing in that chapter of the book, and I really found it very entertaining.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And, you know, those anecdotal stories at the beginning were to introduce those themes. And it's true, you know, the seal trident represents a lot of things. But if you look at the eagle with its head bowed, humility is the greatest, you know, attribute that a warrior has. And what we wanted to do was show that. And it's true, you know, we are deadly and I can't turn that switch and make it happen when the time calls. But at the same time, you know, I've made mistakes. I wasn't afraid to admit them, even, you know, putting them into print. But I think a lot of people can learn from that. You can still achieve greatness, although you make mistakes. And I think a lot of people, when they read that book, will pull that away and do great things with their lives.
Wonderful. Now, you are not the first person I've had on. Many folks we've had on the show joined the military because of 9/11. But you had a closer touch there. A close friend of yours lost his father in those attacks. Correct?
Right. Correct. I went to Xavier High School in Connecticut, and I did well, and I wanted to be a doctor, so I would be the first person in my family to go to a four-year institution. I went to James Madison University in Harrisonburg, Virginia, and I wasn't doing so great. You know, I definitely, when you read the book, you'll know how bad it was, but my second year, the beginning of my second year, the events of 9/11 shook me to the core. My friend's father, Bruce Eagleson, was killed in the Trade Center. And, you know, he was in relative safety. You know, he had come down from the tower that wasn't hit and went back up to get some of his teammates and never made it out of there. And I found myself a few months later sitting in a pew in church, you know, contemplating my life and my direction. I felt that I was in a rut. And I knew, you know, there was evil, obviously. It touched us pretty much the core at James Madison and then also back home in Connecticut, being very close to both the Pentagon and the Trade Centers. And I felt that my skill set as a young man, you know, as a talented athlete, that I could be best served in the U.S. military. And, you know, I went down to the recruiting station in Middletown, Connecticut, you know, with the intention of joining the Marine Corps. And I got there around lunchtime, and they were out to lunch. So I walked into a Navy.
Literally speaking, they were out to lunch.
Literally, there was a sign on the door, be back at 1300. No, the Marines are squared away, but I went to a Navy office, saw a poster on the wall. It said SEALs, and I was hooked from there. I didn't grow up wanting to be a SEAL. I literally walked into the office, saw the poster, and that's what I wanted to do.
Now, just to be clear, Kevin, your entire research and background on the Navy SEALs consisted of watching one very bad Charlie Sheen movie.
Yeah, Charlie Sheen and even worse, Demi Moore. Had I known, you know, Demi Moore, you know, the possibility of her, like, being with me at Buds, you know, I probably would have, like, that would have been my first choice, but No, it was Charlie Sheen's Navy SEALs and, you know, G.I. Jane. And now, I mean, you can't go anywhere without seeing a SEAL movie.
There you go. Ladies and gentlemen, our guest is Kevin Lacy. He's written a best-selling book called The Last Punisher, live here. Now, Kevin, unlike some people you've probably chatted to, I actually did my research, actually read your book, so we're not going to waste any time with any, you know, what's it like to be a Navy SEAL comments or questions. When we come back, I'd like you to answer the question, is a warrior born or is a warrior built, in that debate, and what your answer to that is. Folks, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, live with Kevin Lacy, Navy SEAL. We'll be right back.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined live on the phone by Kevin Lace. I apologize, Kevin, if I called you Lacy. It's Kevin Lace. Kevin is a Navy SEAL. He was a sniper, among other things, in the Battle of Ramadi. He's written a book called The Last Punisher. Kevin, back to you. I found it interesting in reading through your book when you're talking about Buds, and I think you called it the most fun you never want to have again or something like that, but it's interesting. Your philosophy seems to be, correct me if I'm right, sir, that people like yourself that are trained to distribute very violent means upon our enemies are not created so much as they're born. And SEAL training was about identifying and bringing out, identifying those characteristics in people that just had it innately. Is that a reasonable summary of your philosophy on that?
I agree. And, you know, from my perspective, I look at it that SEALs are born, not made. And, you know, there's a lot of warriors that go ahead and, you know, go in the military. Unfortunately, it makes up less than 1% of this country. But when I look at the, you know, the apparatus, which is SEAL training, basic underwater demolition SEAL training, you know, there's an 85% attrition rate. And those numbers really haven't varied all that much between a couple standard deviations over the last, you know, 60-plus years. And there's a reason for that. It's that not everybody has that innate ability to wear the trident, to do the job, which is to be a SEAL, and commit that violent act against a terrorist, against our enemies. And the training process is formulated in such a way that it identifies those that have it versus those that don't. And there are a lot of people who believe they are warriors, but when you're put on the pitch of that, you know, strenuous training, the instructors definitely find out who has it and who doesn't.
Absolutely. Okay, and I'm glad you shared that, because that, as a civilian, the whole point of this show is to educate and inform civilians, and that's why I really enjoyed your book. Now, The Lash Punisher, one of the interesting things to me, Kevin, is you're not a career guy, and that gives you, I think, a somewhat of a different perspective writing about your time with the SEALs. You were in 8 years, if I'm not mistaken?
Correct.
Okay. Now you're with Task Unit Bruiser, Charlie Platoon, SEAL Team 3 in Ramadi. A lot of your book focuses on that. Let's talk about, because some of the things you reveal in this book, and it is a no-hold-barred discussion about some of the things that happened there, and I want to share that with our listeners. But let's get American Sniper out of the way right off the bat. Now, our show, Kevin, is about telling stories. I think there's power in that. For a movie to work, casting is really important. You need the right actor to be able to properly tell the story. The guy they cast as you in the film American Sniper nailed it. He was good.
He was pretty good. He was actually phenomenal. I'm surprised he wasn't nominated for any awards.
Humble, good looking.
Yeah, exactly. All the above. You know, interesting how that happened. I was working with Chris Kyle and Jason Hall on this screenplay prior to Chris getting murdered on February 2nd. And after, in the aftermath of that, Jason, you know, I invited him to come meet the family and see, you know, the team guys out in Dallas. And he went back to Hollywood and pushed for me to be the technical advisor on the movie, which it wasn't until I had a meeting a few months later with Clint Eastwood that I got the job. I found myself the next day after meeting Clint on the range training Bradley Cooper, and we were about 1 hour into the training, and I had him hitting. I was training with another frogman buddy of mine, Rick. We got him hitting targets at, you know, 500 meters, and he's getting pretty proficient. But he kept saying, "You need to play yourself in the movie. You need to play your character Dauber," which is my nickname. And I told him, I was like, "Hey, we're gonna get you ready, you know, correct to play Chris, and then we'll worry about me." He's like, "No, you need to do it." And I was at a full-time grad school program at Wake Forest, physician assistant studies. So I left California, went back to Winston-Salem, and the casting director emailed me and said, "You should audition for yourself. Here are the sides. Put it on an iPhone and send it back." Well, I never acted in my life. I used to run away from that. I played sports. I didn't act. So I did the best I could. My wife filmed me on an iPhone. We sent it in to Jeff Miklak, the casting director. I got a call back like 2 days later. He's like, "Hey, Kevin, or can I call you Dauber?" And I was like, "You know, Dauber's fine." He's like, "Well, I showed the tapes to Clint, and Clint said, 'Boy, damn good, get him a job.'" And then next thing you know, 2 weeks later, I was on my way to Morocco to start filming the movie as a technical advisor and as an actor.
Well, Kevin, just so you know, in my show notes, I specifically wanted to ask you to do your Clint Eastwood voice. That's pretty good. Let's talk now. So Bradley was a pretty quick study, I'm guessing.
Yeah, he was. You know, unfortunately, he never had the opportunity to meet Chris. His only interaction was over the phone, I think, once, and he relied heavily on interviews, spoken word, and obviously reading Chris's book. And my job was to connect him with, you know, people that knew Chris well, and to immerse himself in Chris Kyle, because what he was attempting to do was to portray a character study of Chris. And I think he did a great job. You know, mind you, Bradley's an actor. Chris was the real deal. And I think, you know, as close as you can come to a suitable, you know, representative of Chris, I think Bradley did a phenomenal job.
Now, Kevin, I want to talk about the things that you didn't see in the movie, and you certainly wouldn't see in a Charlie Sheen movie, but were revealed in your book that were very enlightening. And some of them were almost, you know, some of them kind of make you smile because you don't think about it. Things like combat chainsaw and, you know, the necessary proficiency of a Navy SEAL at all tools available, when you need it to prepare the battlefield, if you will. But some things, Kevin, just, they make me shake my head, and I can't imagine what you and your comrades went through. One of the things that happens very often in the book is you had certain rules of engagement over there, particularly as a sniper. You'd kill a bad guy, his buddies would come out with a white flag but not carrying weapons, and you had to allow them to collect his body. That's crazy.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling. You know, I had some people with after the aftermath of sniper, and they're like, oh, no, that's not accurate. And I'm like, good, well, it's not supposed to give away secrets to the enemy as to what we do. You know, it's just a movie. But I think what Sniper showed was that entry into what it's like to be behind the gun and, you know, your ROEs, rules of engagement. And in real life, you know, the movie is the movie. There's some insight into ROEs, but in real life, and you get that from The Last Punisher, of what you can shoot and what you can't shoot.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not indiscriminate trigger pullers out there. We're a very surgical element. You know, we are meant to exact, you know, a lethal amount of force on an enemy that deserves it. But at the same time, we're not just mowing everybody down. And we do put fear in the enemy, especially through the sniper craft. And it is frustrating to be behind the gun, and you'll see a nefarious individual walk up with an AK-47, and you'll dump them. And then, you know, the white flag of truce will come out, the white flag will come out, and they'll come collect him up and leave the gun. And you know those are his buddies that probably have their weapons stacked around the corner of the building, and you can't do anything about it. But at the same time, you know, in order to uphold the standard which we represent as stewards of the American flag, you know, we hold ourselves to that standard. We don't dip down to the savagery of the enemy that we fight.
Bingo. And I'm glad you said that. I think we need to respect the white flag of truce, but I also give you odds that they wouldn't accord you the same respect. Folks, your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. We're joined by Kevin Lace. Kevin is a Navy SEAL, the author of the best-selling book, The Last Punisher. Stick around. We'll be right back with more from Kevin. Hey, check us out, AmericanWarriorRadio.com. This show and all the shows archived there for your listening pleasure.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. Your host, BBG. We're joined live on the phone by SEAL Team Sniper Kevin Lace. He's the author of the bestseller, The Last Punisher, A SEAL Team 3 Sniper's True Account of the Battle of Ramadi. You can find out more about Kevin or get his book at kevinlace.com. Spelled a little bit differently, Kevin. KevinLace.com. Kevin, we're talking about some of the enlightening things that you revealed in your book. We just had that ad about a Mexican food legend restaurant here in Tucson. And of course, Chris Kyle was known as the legend. I didn't know. It's been a while since I saw American Sniper. I don't know if this was in the movie or not, but there was one instance where Chris shot two enemies on a moped with one bullet. After they were, you guys saw them dumping what you thought was an IED. And the ridiculous part of that is I didn't realize there were paperwork involved in war. Kevin?
Oh, there's a ton of paper. You can't hide from it. No, it didn't make the movie, but it definitely made The Last Punisher, and we talk about it in detail. We were working just north of Cop Falcon in South Central Ramadi, and we were overlooking this, this east to west long road, and it was, to the right was a graveyard, which was kind of funny in and of itself, because I'm sure we filled a little bit of it during our time over there. But we were looking and we're patrolling that, or we're watching that street for people dropping IEDs to prevent, you know, Marine patrols from hitting them. And Chris had seen, I just transferred off the gun from Chris, and I was watching on binos, and Chris was on the scope, and he saw some movement at about 800 meters out, and I was able to go ahead and look on into that sector, and there was a guy that dropped an IED on the back of a moped as they were driving along, heading our way. And Chris allowed the guys to, and that was, you know, obviously hostile action. And as soon as those guys made it up to about 150 some odd yards, Chris hit both of them with 300 Win Mag, you know, hitting both of them and killing both of them. Well, where they landed was at a four-way intersection, and the Marines and the Humvees, who were a couple hundred yards away, just saw two guys on a moped, pink mist, and they both fall. So they came down, saw that, and then went and checked out the road and then the IED hole, and they found nothing. So we had to go fill out shooter statements and, you know, deal with a lot of the blowback from that. And it struck me to the core. Like, I was a new guy at the time. You know, I knew the enemy's bad. I worked with the Marine ground pounders. But what really chapped me was the amount of paperwork that would come from the JAGs, you know, to scrutinize your decision on the battlefield. And I think the difference with SEALs is everybody's a thinking shooter. You know, everybody thinks you need an officer to run every little tidbit that you're doing, but SEALs are able to operate in the absence of leadership and take command. So when you're behind the gun and you're a sniper, you know the repercussions of your actions. You feel justified when you take that action because you're a thinking shooter. So as a new guy seeing that paperwork, it really frustrated me.
Now, Kevin, unless I misinterpreted your book, I mean, you saw them doing this. What's most likely is in between the time they dropped it, Chris made the shot, and the Marines got back there, somebody collected the explosive. Is that
correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, there's as soon as there's a shot fired, you know, everybody scatters, and, you know, the going rate was $200 to place an IED in a hole, so all somebody had to do was pick that up. I mean, capitalism wasn't dead over there.
Yeah, well, I tell you guys were doing so well, you were in high demand, even to the point where you were asked to do something called presence controls, which, if I get this correctly, Kevin, it means you walked down the middle of the street trying to get someone to shoot at you. Is that the Reader's Digest version?
That's verbatim, exactly. You know, we actually had, you know, patrols where we would patrol to contact, which usually ended up with, you know, one of us getting shot, or as one of my fellow machine gunners, Biff, took one right off the helmet and off his night vision mount. We had a couple of Jundies. One was shot in the face. And we would just patrol to contact to show the enemy that we weren't scared. And then we'd strong point a building, call an armament, and they would, you know, neutralize or at least provide some cover, and we would exfil out. And that was one of the things that we did over there to, you know, empower the Iraqi army and Iraqi security forces. And then, you know, questionable at the how effective that was, but it was one of the mission sets we did.
Now, it wasn't all excitement. There were some situations you talk about in the book where things were a little slow, a little dry, so you did things like running an American flag up on the roof of where you had your hide to try and attract attention. But let me talk about, because I love Westerns, Kevin, you adapted kind of the idea of the, you know, the old cowboy trick of putting your hat up on a stick till someone shoots at that. You had kind of your own little Wilson thing going on, didn't you?
Yeah, it was the same time we launched an American flag. We had to finish that story, we had one of our SEAL patrols going, you know, two streets over, patrolling to contact. And they started taking some heavy fire, effective fire. So I carried an American flag in between my hard plates and my soft plates, and we ran it up an aluminum pole to draw fire. But when it was slow, you know, I would take my helmet off and, you know, wrap a towel around a stick, usually like a little, painter pole, and, put the helmet on there, draw a little face, put some sunglasses and try and draw some fire. Eventually, I finally thought of how thin the walls were. Probably wasn't the best use of intelligence, but fortunately, nobody shot it off.
Yeah, and Dauber, doesn't that sort of refer to new guy?
Yeah, that refers to me. I walked into the platoon space in 2005, and Chris had just come back from Fallujah, and he was sitting, you know, kind of lazily in a couch, and walks on over. He's like, that big goofy dude, that's Dauber right there. And my LPO the same time was laughing. He's like, that's a Dauber for sure. And this was back before smartphones. I couldn't look it up right then and there. I had to go home and fire up the desktop, and I found it was Dauber from Coach, the big goofy guy.
Okay, well, that's all right. You new guy, but eventually you came around.
I did.
Yeah, it's interesting. Another learning experience. You talked about when your officer told you to take point, and you were Charlie 13, as in only take over if Charlie 1 through 12 were down. So you eventually worked your way up, right?
I worked my way up, but that just goes. We had some great. That platoon had some of the best enlisted leadership ever, and my platoon chief Tony was one of those guys who made me a better frogman. Chris was another one, and I had a bunch of E6s and E5s to look up to that had been there, done that. And our officer corps, our task unit commander had been there, done that. But you know, the majority of our officers were new or relatively new. So it was the enlisted corps that made it happen. And like I said, you know, what makes SEALs dynamic and different is that anybody can lead, whether it's Charlie 13. But when the situation calls, a SEAL will step up and do the job because that's how we train and that's how we fight.
Wonderful. Folks, again, the book is The Last Punisher, A SEAL Team 3 Sniper's True Account of the Battle of Ramadi. You can find it on Amazon. Of course, you can always visit Kevin's webpage. He does a lot of public speaking, a lot of motivational speaking. Just a great guy. Write this down. It's KevinLacz.com. When we come back, we'll talk more with Kevin about his friendship with the legend, Chris Kyle, and then some of his other thoughts on philosophies on how being a SEAL has prepared him for other things in life, and some of his comrades we've even had here on the show before. Stick around, folks. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We'll be right back.
My daddy served in the Army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard till the day that he died. He wanted my mother, my brother, my sister, and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free.
If you want to discuss those who serve the red, white, and blue, dial 520-751-1041. Now, back to the American Warrior.
And we lit up your world.
Welcome back, folks. Your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Hey, would you like to be a part in presenting this essential programming? Visit Patreon.com, Patreon.com. Search American Warrior Radio. If you make an investment, you'll be rewarded with items related to some of our past show guests, including a 50-caliber bottle breacher produced by Navy SEAL Eli Crane. Kevin, we had your comrade or teammate, I guess, Eli Crane on the show before. He sends his greetings. We also had an author named Robert Vera, who is the author of a book called The Warrior's Faith, that is a very, very compelling story about the life of Ryan Biggles, Job. In your book, The Last Punisher, you talk about that situation and Ryan's wound there, but then also, I guess I want to talk about as a combat medic yourself, it's bad enough to see one of your comrades killed or wounded, but is there an extra burden upon you as a medic in those cases where you kind of, you know, mentally, psychologically think, man, I could have done something or I should have done something? Or
I mean, you know, you can always armchair quarterback or Monday morning quarterback it. You know, as a medic, fortunately, the training that we received, I went to the Special Operations Combat Medic School at Fort Bragg, and we were inundated with, you know, trauma to prepare for that moment. But then you go to your SEAL team, which I went to SEAL Team 3, and then you meet the people who you may one day treat, and you develop these bonds. And I think it can do one of two things. One, it can paralyze you when they're injured. Or two, it can invigorate you to work harder to save them. And for me, it was more the latter. And, you know, being a medic is something you take seriously. It's not just a cool job to put down on a resume if you want to become a paramedic or like a physician assistant, which is what I do now. But it's a life-saving skill. You know, somebody can jump on the radio and learn a radio if they're under duress, or they're on escape and evasion. You know, somebody can learn how to pick up a gun and shoot if they need to, but not everybody can save a life like a special operations medic can. So the training we do is hard, it's strenuous, because the lives that we save matter. Every life on the battlefield on the coalition side matters. And to see Mark Lee, you know, on the ground, or see Biggles hurt, you know, it hurts, but at the same time, you block that out, you go to your space, you do your job. And then when that situation passes, then it's time to go ahead and think about it. But at the time, you know, we all did our job and we did it to the best of our ability.
Now, Kevin, I've got a philosophy on this, particularly after reading your book, The Last Punisher. As a sniper, when you shoot a bad guy that's about to plant a bomb that could seriously kill or maim Army soldiers or Marines or some of your fellow Navy SEALs, you're saving lives as well, not only as a medic. So I would propose that in both cases you're saving lives, but I want to ask a question from that perspective. We've had Surgeon General Richard Carmona on, who was a Green Beret medic in Vietnam, also Dr. Josh Apple, who was the PJ on the Marcus Luttrell rescue. You're now a physician's assistant. What talk a little bit about that warrior slash healer dynamic. You're both.
Right. You know, I think the more, you know, as a young frogman, you know, I wanted to get in the fight. And as a sniper, I was able to do that. You know, there's not much remorse or anything felt when you use that violent, that lethal force when it comes to the enemy. You know, you're protecting because we've been out on the streets with the Army and the Marines. And I do agree, you are saving lives and you're making that battlefield safer for the people that matter. And as the healer, you know, being a medic wasn't something that, you know, I relished to get the chance to use that skill set, because you know if you're going to use that skill set, then one of your closest friends, one of your brothers is harmed. Mm-hmm. But I feel, you know, galvanized by those experiences as I transitioned out of the military that, you know, I'm very good at those skill sets and I can use that towards, you know, something more. And the physician assistant route was something that attracted me because I saw PAs work overseas. I saw how dynamic they were, how they were able to work in surgical teams, and I saw myself doing that. And going out into the civilian side, I think I can share my experiences and what that, you know, calmness under pressure, because calmness is contagious. And it helped, you know, I truly believe it helped people that I worked with, and, you know, their skill sets helped rub off on me.
Now, when you're in the field, you're in combat, you kind of sort of expect people are going to get hurt, people are going to get killed, but you talk, referred to in the book a couple of times. One is, of course, the death of Ryan Jobe, who, based on the interviews we had in the book, I would propose to you, I mean, basically, I don't want to say he was murdered, but that's a shame that he lost his life in a hospital. But also, Chris Kyle was a mentor of yours. I didn't realize this until I read your book, Kevin, that the screenplay writer for American Sniper finished the first draft of the script the day before Chris Kyle was murdered. And you received a phone call. I think you were out with Lindsay when the call came about that.
Right. Yeah. I was working at that time. I was working with Chris at Kraft International. I was writing for him, while I was going through grad school, and together Jason Hall, myself and Chris worked on the screenplay. And yeah, Jason finished it that Friday before, and Chris never had the opportunity to read it. And the next day, you know, I talked to Chris that Friday. I texted him that Saturday morning, and I was out at a birthday party for a buddy of mine in grad school, and I got the call from Stephen Young, the CEO of Kraft International, telling me the news. And it was, you know, it was literally like that, you know, feeling I've never felt before, because, you know, when you lose a buddy in combat, and even now when I hear buddies who have gone to the other side, you know, you realize it's in combat. You know, that's a burden that you assume when you sign on that dotted line. And I feel at ease with that. So, you know, obviously with Biggles and then with Chris, you know, it's a dirty feeling, especially when Chris was murdered. And it took a while to, you know, really wrap my head around that. And, you know, it's crazy when you think back, like, you know, it's been X amount of years since that happened. And it still feels very real, very, 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 you know, like it happened yesterday.
Well, Kevin, I got to tell you, I appreciate, you know, words do matter, and there is a very strong distinction between being killed and being murdered, and I'm glad that you've used that word in the context of Chris Kyle and the shameful thing that happened to him, ended his life far too early. Now, you, in your book, you talk about Chris is, I mentioned you considered him a mentor, but you said he was really the ultimate team player.
Right. You know, when I talk about Chris, you know, you always have that member on your team that, knows everything, right? And people always snicker when I say that. And I show a picture of Chris. But Chris had the uncanny ability to share, when he knew everything. And that was the most, the most important part of being a new sniper was you knew how to squeeze a trigger and hit a target. But you don't know what it's like in the in-between, especially after you go ahead and exact that shot, and how you're going to feel. And I think having discussions with Chris and, you know, Chris mentoring you, you know, it wasn't in front of everybody. It was just pulled aside. Well, hey, this is what to expect and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I felt that put not just me at ease, but other, you know, snipers at ease who had never been in those shoes before. And Chris knew everything. But his ability to disseminate that information and make you feel comfortable, is what made our team better, especially our crew of snipers. And I, you know, the mentorship that Chris shared, is something that I definitely take and try and pass on to people that I try and mentor going forward.
Now, I tell you, one of my favorite quotes out of your book was, in the world of special operations, there is no extra weight. You talk about everybody on the team having a job to do, and there was a scenario where some bad guys had placed a IED at the front door of a building where you guys had your hide, and if it wasn't for those explosive ordnance disposal team members, that would have been a bad day for y'all.
Right, and, you know, we just lost Scott Dayton the other day in Syria, and there is no extra weight in special operations. Everybody has their role, and they do it to the best of their ability and beyond, and our EOD guys were no exception to that. You know, Nick, who's a great friend of mine, and JB, they saved our lives. You know, we had everybody – we were in a big, you know, apartment complex, and we got attacked, and it was probably like a 20, 30-minute firefight. Just enough to keep our heads down for us to, you know, let's get up and shoot back and stop it. But in that interim, they had placed a 155 round at the front door, and we had our, later on in the evening, we were exfilling out of that. We had everybody stacked at that door about to leave, and Nick was on top, and he looked down and saw the command wire running to another building, and he called Avalanche, and we all got out of there and, you know, saved everybody's life that day. And that happened countless times, and you hear it when you're out, like these EOD guys who save lives, these boat guys that save lives, these pilots that save lives, and there is no extra weight in special operations, and people take their jobs seriously.
Kevin, one of the other things you mentioned, I guess this is a motto for the SEALs, you have to earn your Trident every day. You're continuing to do that out in your community. Tell us a little bit about Hunting for Heroes. We got about 2 minutes left.
Sure. Hunting for Healing is a charity that we started with my wife. My wife actually has her brainchild, but it's to take soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines, and their spouses on hunting, fishing, and outdoor activities as a way to promote communication, that bond. And after I got out of the military, you know, my team wasn't as close as it used to be, and I kind of felt like I was on my own island. And my wife was really that rock, and, you know, she enhanced that communication, and our bond grew stronger, which made that transition easier, and made us together more successful. So we try and, you know, impart that on other, couples, and we have a couple trips. One of them, we're taking a couple to Costa Rica, bill fishing, two couples, and then, we're actually going to Africa on a 5-day plains animal hunt, with a ranger and an Air Force EOD guy.
Wonderful. And folks, you can find out more information about that, huntingforhealing.org. I assume you'll take donations, Kevin?
Absolutely. And we're going to be doing a big fundraiser in March in Orange Beach, but you can go to www.huntingforhealing.org and make donations and learn more about our charity.
Well, Kevin, thank you so much for spending time with us here on Sunday. Hold the phone. I want to chat with you a little bit after the program is over, folks. His name is Kevin Lace. Great book. Honestly, I read it. I enjoyed it. It's called The Last Punisher. You can get it on Amazon.com or visit his website, KevinLace.com. It's spelled KevinLacz.com. You can find us on AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Podcasts will be available on iTunes, Stitcher.com, or right here, 1041KQTH.com. Look at us on Facebook, American Warrior Radio. You can follow us on Twitter at Warrior Radio TUC. Again, thanks to Kevin. Thanks to all those ladies and gentlemen, those men and women who protect our nation every day. And, folks, see one, thank one. Thanks for tuning in. Share the story. We'll see you next week.